Ordinarily, an honorary consul is not expected to do much more than get drunken sailors out of jail, ship dead citizens home, and generally show the flag. But Joanne Herring acted as if she had been made a full-fledged ambassador or minister of trade. She was suddenly organizing benefits, even one in which all of her designer friends, Pierre Cardin, Oscar de la Renta, Emilio Pucci, were shanghaied into coming up with designs for Pakistani craftsmen to use as patterns. She plunged into Pakistani villages on fact-finding missions, giving the poverty-stricken Muslims inspirational talks on capitalism, and inspiring hope with her idea that each village could get rich selling beautifully made dresses and rugs designed by her famous friends. There was no precedent for an American woman playing such a role on behalf of the Pakistani government, so Pakistan honored Herring with the official status of Honorary Man. She was addressed as Sir. Back in the United States, she managed to put the out-of-favor Pakistan diplomats in the limelight, including them at elegant black-tie dinners with the likes of Henry Kissinger and Nelson Rockefeller. It was all going very well until the military seized power and hung President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, perhaps best known today as the father of Benazir Bhutto. President Jimmy Carter led the charge in condemning the new dictator, Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq, accusing him of killing democracy in Pakistan as well as of building an Islamic atomic bomb. Carter cut off all military and economic assistance, declaring Pakistan unworthy of further U.S. aid. When Pakistan became a dirty word in Washington, another honorary consul might have lost heart. Herring, however, reacted differently. The Count de Meringe had recently confided in her that there were only 7 men standing between the free world and communism. Zia, he said, was one of them. So that year she set off for Pakistan, prepared to find virtue in the maligned dictator Zia-ul-Haq. In Islamabad, Zia quickly won her heart. He invited her to dinner at his simple military headquarters, explaining that he would never move into Bhutto's palace as long as his people were starving. The unexpected surprise of this visit was the astonishing impact Herring had on Zia. He was a fundamentalist Muslim, and she a born-again Christian. Yet by all accounts, their bond grew so strong that for a time, she is said to have been Zia's most trusted American advisor, a development that Foreign Minister Yaqub Khan found alarming. She absolutely had his ear. It was terrible, he said. It was all the more unusual given that Zia was in the process of reimposing fundamentalist restrictions on women. But he was so spellbound by Herring and took her so seriously that to the utter dismay of his entire foreign office, he made her Pakistan's roving ambassador to the world and even awarded her his country's highest civilian honor, the title of Qaid-e-Azam, or Great Leader. Charlie Wilson says that Zia would leave cabinet meetings just to take Joanne's calls. There was no affair with Zia, Wilson recalls, but it's impossible to deal with Joanne and not deal with her on a sexual basis. No matter who you are, you take those phone calls. When the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 1979, Zia's relationship with the United States could not have been worse, nor could he have been closer to his honorary consul, who took the novel position with the dictator that the invasion was a great blessing in disguise. At last, there were Russians crossing the border, she told him. Before, they were just using nicknames like FMLN or FSMLN. But now, they were Russians, and I knew there was a possibility of doing something. That kind of bravado was typical of Joanne Herring, who at age 48 was accustomed to seizing and holding center stage and refusing to let anything get her down. She had married 2 men, raised 2 boys, and worked 5 days a week for 12 hours a day on her television talk show. She was one of the social dragons of Houston and a tireless promoter of Pakistan. But the year after the invasion, for the first time in her life, she felt defeated. She found that no one seemed to want to hear about Zia or Pakistan, much less about Afghanistan. It seemed that life was passing her by, and she felt alone. After a long struggle, her husband had died of cancer, and Joanne turned to her church in Houston, where she remembers sobbing at the altar in a state of complete despair. "I never thought I would laugh again," she says. "I thought my life was over." Joanne Herring remembers those dark days with a shudder, but mainly she remembers how Charlie Wilson arrived to save her life. They had met 2 years before at one of her River Oaks parties, after he had passed an important piece of oil and gas legislation that her husband had thought impossible. Joanne collected powerful men, and as she told him about the virtues of Pakistan, she locked eyes with the handsome congressman. Wilson left with the distinct impression that Joanne Herring had been flirting with him, so he was delighted when she called him one day out of the blue in the midst of her depression. It is said that hypochondriacs make the best nurses, and if Charlie Wilson was responsible for lifting Joanne Herring from her depression back in 1981, then it was because he knew where she was coming from. Very few were aware of the depths of Charlie Wilson's frequent depressions, the insomnia, the alcoholism, the asthma, the trips to the doctor, the constant loneliness. He disguised it well. No matter what his inner mood, whenever the public door opened, the darkness disappeared, replaced by the bigger-than-life can-do Texan. For Joanne Herring, that overflowing energy was like a miracle cure. "Charlie taught me to laugh again and made my life really wonderful," she said. A curious romance began, with much talk of Christ, anti-communism, and Zia-ul-Haq. As the weeks passed, she found her spirits returning. "Everyone else's eyes would glaze over when I would talk about the Afghans, but Charlie was interested in these things." As the romance bloomed, Herring found herself reborn as a ferocious champion of Zia and the Afghans, and she became convinced that Wilson was the one who could save the day. "I really gave Zia a story on Charlie," she recalls, "because I was scared someone could do an investigation of Charlie and write him off. I told Zia, 'This is the man who can really do it for you.' You see, they were very frightened of America." Joanne also began to use all of her wiles to pull Wilson into the Afghan war. "I knew that if he was serious about something, he went all out. I'd say to Charlie, 'You are powerful, you are wonderful. Just think what you can do.' It had to be a sort of brainwashing," she explained. "But it was very easy because Charlie thought in those terms, too. You can raise that spirit in a Texan. It's there." Wilson, now fully under Herring's sway, quickly accepted her invitation to River Oaks to meet the man who, she said, would explain it all. "You will adore this man," she told Wilson. "There have been 18 books written about him. He has been decorated by every country in the world. To give you an idea, he was the first man in the Belgian Congo after the bloodbath. He married 11 Jewish girls to get them out of Nazi Germany and said he didn't have one honeymoon. Every time there has been a disaster in the world, Charles Fawcett was there. You will never meet anybody like him." For those who don't know her, there are times when Joanne Herring sounds quite detached from reality. But the stories she told about Fawcett turn out to be largely true, including her account of how he had recently lured her into Afghanistan. She explained that 6 months earlier she had been at home in River Oaks when a message from Afghanistan came in via the underground. It was from her friend Charles Fawcett, a note scribbled with crayons on the back of a child's notebook. "Come immediately. Bring film equipment. The world doesn't know what's going on here." It was hard for the congressman not to be impressed as he listened to Joanne describe how she had left immediately for Islamabad and then crossed into the war zone with Fawcett. "All this had to be very secretive," she whispered conspiratorially. "Zia sent his planes and helicopters with us to the border. He even sent troops to areas where they were not supposed to go. You see, the least little thing could have created a Russian invasion. Zia kept telling me that the Russians wanted nothing more than for his troops to cross over so they could justify an invasion. They dressed me like a man. I had a bodyguard who was 7 feet tall with a handlebar mustache and an Enfield rifle." At one point, Joanne told Wilson, this giant moved her about in a barrel to hide her. "It was so cold that all the men gave me their blankets, but it was like sleeping under a dead hippo. I was so cold, it was horrible, but it was the most exciting thing in my life.